From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If America goes to war with Saddam Hussein and wins, it shoulders huge responsibilities for rebuilding Iraq from the very moment of victory. In this hour, James Fallows joins us for a hard look at war and occupation in Iraq. It looks like a short road in and a long road out. But first, today, President Bush asked Congress for authority to use all means he determines to be appropriate, including force, to disarm and overthrow Saddam Hussein. The president said the United States will take action on its own if the U.N. Security Council balks. Jonathan Broder is foreign affairs editor for Congressional Quarterly. He joins us live from Washington. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Broder.
Hi, Tom.
So the resolution that we just heard about yesterday has arrived today. What's in it?
Well, it's a very sweeping resolution, and it's a draft that the White House has sent to Congress. It's a 20-paragraph resolution that would authorize Bush to, and I'm quoting now, to, quote, use all means that he determines to be appropriate, including force, in order to enforce United Nations Security Council resolutions, to defend the national security interests of the United States against the threat posed by Iraq, and to restore international peace and security in the region, close quote. So that's a pretty sweeping resolution. I mean, it calls for the use of force to overthrow Saddam, but it also gives the president power and authority to restore international peace and security in the region, which means that this gives the president the authority to go beyond Iraq and possibly places like Yemen or Sudan or other countries in the region that the president deems as threatening international peace and security.
It's a very broad mandate. What has the response been from Congress?
Well, they say that they're going to take about 2 weeks to debate this and discuss it. But as of now, the Republicans are pretty well behind the president on this. And there are a considerable number of Democrats that are behind the president as well. But there are some Democrats that are very wary of giving the president a blank check, and they include the majority leader, Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota. But I would hasten to add that on this kind of vote, which is a very important vote and probably the most important vote that some of these lawmakers are ever going to make, it would be very, very hard for a party leader like Daschle to impose party discipline.
How hard is the Bush administration pushing for exactly this language to be approved, that is, the broad writ that would let them, if necessary, as you and a number of congressmen today are, Senator Evan Bayh in Indiana said he worried that the wording was too broad and could be used to go beyond Iraq. Others raised that as well. How hard is the White House insisting that this needs to be, this must be, the resolution, the green light they get from Congress?
Very hard is the answer. And the argument that they're making is that such a resolution that's approved by Congress strengthens the hand of Secretary of State Powell as he negotiates in New York with other members of the Security Council for a tough UN resolution. And they cite past incidents in American history when the president had the backing of Congress behind them. It actually averted crises in Cuba in the 60s and in the Middle East in the 50s.
Jonathan Broder, how does this resolution compare to others that Congress has passed to allow the country to go to military action, for example, to the resolution that preceded the Gulf War?
Well, it's stronger. The Gulf War resolution in 1991 authorized the president only to use force to expel Iraq from Kuwait. It did not call for regime change. So in that sense, it's stronger than the 1991 resolution. And it's also stronger than a 98 resolution that Congress passed, which permitted President Clinton to launch airstrikes against Iraq after the U.N. inspectors were withdrawn.
We see Senate Republican leader Trent Lott of Mississippi predicting a large bipartisan vote in favor of the resolution, saying he imagines it will be on the Senate floor by early October. That's coming right up. When might we see this through both houses of Congress, if it goes through?
I think by early October we will, and I think it will pass because there's an election coming up. This is a vote that's going to be taken before an election. And I think on this kind of vote, Democrats do not want to be seen as backing away from a popular president on a matter of war and peace.
Jonathan Broder, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jonathan Broder is foreign affairs editor with Congressional Quarterly. He spoke with us from Washington. So the assumption is that if and when it comes, U.S. forces will win a war with Iraq. What happens after victory is far less certain. After the Gulf War, America packed its bags and went home. This time around, that is not likely to be an option. Like Germany and Japan after World War II, a defeated Iraq will almost certainly require an American occupation and an American reconstruction. James Fallows, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, has taken a long, hard look at this war's aftermath in a powerful piece in the magazine's November issue entitled The 51st State. Fallows says the day after a war ended, Iraq would become America's problem for practical and political reasons because we would have destroyed the political order and done physical damage in the process. The claims on American resources would be comparable to those of any U.S. state. And there is the prospect. Iraq as America's 51st state in the heart of the Middle East for years. Do you agree with James Fallows that the United States would be obligated to make a long-term commitment to Iraq after Saddam Hussein is removed from power? And does regime change mean opportunity or tar baby? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Dallas, Texas, is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Good evening, and welcome, James Fallows.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to talk with you.
Good to talk with you, and thanks for joining us tonight. It's an incredible piece. You've gone in great detail after talking with a lot of people about what the aftermath of a war with Iraq might look like, James Fallows. There are four stars, or I forget the number, but there are stars on Iraq's flag. Are you suggesting that the United States, at least psychologically, needs to take one of them and put it on the American flag if we're going in here? It's a catchy headline, the 51st state. But why think about Iraq as a 51st state post-war?
Well, for a reason, I think you exactly get the point. It's a way of thinking about what we'd be undertaking as if we feel compelled to launch a preemptive war against Iraq. The argument of this piece is not necessarily that we should not go to war with Iraq because it depends on what the justifications are, but it's saying that the only realistic assumption about that war is that it would be the first stage of a decades-long involvement in that part of the world. And interestingly, some of the strongest proponents of the war are the ones who are most honest about that prospect of saying that we'd be there for the very long haul.
And yet, the amount of conversation about what a post-war commitment in Iraq might mean has been relatively muted, it seems to me. Do you share that perspective? And why do you think that's so, James Fallows?
Well, I think there's been an interesting shift. Until maybe 2 months ago, I did most of the reporting for this piece through the summer months, and I was talking to people who had run past occupations, whether in Japan or Germany or Somalia or Bosnia or you name it. And until maybe a month or 6 weeks ago, most people who were strongly in favor of a war were sort of categorically against thinking about the post-war consequences, because almost by definition, they became an anti-war argument. They said there's going to be anything to think about. And there was kind of a subgroup among these people who were saying that it didn't really matter what the consequences were, because by definition, anything minus Saddam Hussein would be better than the scenario plus Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. But there's been a kind of interesting wedge within the pro-war camp of people saying that not simply would there be the negative virtue of a war of getting rid of Saddam Hussein, but there'd be a positive long-term opportunity to create a democratic capitalist society in the Middle East.
So fabulous opportunity, in Donald Rumsfeld's word.
Yes, indeed. He was saying it was a bizarrely Richard Simmons-like moment in one of his press conferences, and saying it would be just fabulous to remake them. And so I think for reasons both of this split within the pro-war camp and just the march of history, we're beginning seriously to discuss this undertaking. I think this will begin to come to the fore, prospects.
James Fallows, we're going to get into these details, and you lay them out in great clarity here. But I want to talk first about your observation that peering past a war always tests the limits of human imagination, and that humans specifically, or perhaps Americans in this case, are challenged by what's required to imagine the long-term consequences of war. World War II and Hitler have been raised often as an analogy. We must stop this Hitler. But you say the Great War, World War I, is really the more relevant example. Why?
World War I, occupies much less memory space in modern Americans' minds than it probably should, for understandable reasons. You know, it's almost a century ago. And yet, if you look at that war, what is most striking and what was common wisdom during the time, say, of the John Kennedy administration during the Cuban Missile Crisis, was how things got out of control and how the consequences of that war were more destructive to almost everyone than any of the participants could have imagined. That, you know, a year before the war, if they'd realized that it would have been the destruction of all the empires of Europe and the Middle East, and that the only possible arguable beneficiary of the war was the United States, which sort of began its rise to empire with the damage done to Britain, nobody could have found a sort of reasonable stake in undertaking the combat in World War One.
And do you cite that to say that it's simply unfathomable what lies on the other side of war, or are you suggesting specifically that Iraq could be the thread that unravels the sweater of world order as we know it?
I'm not suggesting this is like the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand tipping off World War One, but I am saying that one reason why the military generally is much more reluctant about this war than are the political leaders is the military has been sort of conditioned to think about what are the unintended, unimagined consequences of combat. You know, strangely, in the time since Vietnam, we've sort of over-imagined the risks of combat itself, and I think come to under-imagine the consequences in the long term. And that's what some of the people I was talking with were trying to go through, how you would start to categorize the consequences and then the ones you couldn't think of.
We're going to walk through those categories, but two points we need to hit first. Number one, why can't this be an in-and-out conflict? And number two, why is America's responsibility here, its obligation, its strategic commitment, whether or not it wants it, likely to be, as you put it, on a par with that in Japan and Germany after World War II? Why will America be committed to hold together and rebuild Iraq? Why not just in and out?
Well, to answer those, starting with the first, the in and out is, you know, if you could sort of magically assassinate Saddam Hussein and his dozen most important henchmen by a death ray, by a ninja squad, and just not do any other damage except to the intended leaders, then maybe you could just walk away and say, not our problem anymore. But realistically, by the time you destroy him, either you will have bombarded the country, killing lots of people, or you will have had some tens of thousands of men and thousands of tanks rolling in there. There's going to be a whole lot of damage that we will have done and the Iraqi army will have done by the time the fighting is over, even if it's only a week or 2 weeks. There are going to be a lot of people killed.
We've made rubble before and not stuck around to rebuild. Why here?
Not on this scale, not preemptively, and not unilaterally. And I think there is, it's interesting, this is sort of a side note, but I'll just note it. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how much stress the U.S. military places on whether this is unilateral or not. A lot of their resistance depends on the idea that the U.S. Army all alone, the U.S. forces all alone would be doing this. It would feel much different if they thought there was some Arab cover, some NATO cover, so that we could share the responsibility for cleaning up after the war.
But it's been repeated even today that if the U.N. Security Council doesn't go, the U.S. and its friends, however few that may be, are prepared to do it.
They are, and the military will, of course, obey the dictates of the political leadership, and it looks as if, as we were hearing a moment ago, as if there will be a vote in Congress authorizing it. But the military was saying it's not realistic to think that when you've killed some number of thousands of people, you have your own tanks in the country, you can just say, we're going home. It would take weeks to get people out of there to begin with, and you can imagine the CNN coverage, they say nothing of Al Jazeera or nothing of NPR about all the misery that necessarily would have been done there by our weapons.
And if it's primarily on the U.S. hook, if it's primarily a U.S.-led, a U.S.-instigated invasion, you say that's profoundly different from a UN or kind of global coalition attack.
Well, let's think of two just very practical illustrations of that. One is how much easier it would be if you had an Arab force to do the policing, the interrogation, the search for criminals, the talking to people, because they can speak Arabic. They look like the locals. They are Muslims, et cetera, as the U.S. Army generally is not on any of those counts. There also is a point that a number of students of the post-World War II occupation, including John Dower of MIT, made to me, which is that one huge advantage in the occupation of Germany and Japan is that nobody questioned the legitimacy of the U.S. being there. You know, we've been attacked in both cases. We were crushing tyrannies. You know, we'd beaten them thoroughly.
But this time there may be a question. James Fallows, forgive me. We've got to take a short break. Listeners, we're talking about the aftermath of war, occupation, and Iraq is almost a 51st state. Do you agree that going in alone or something like alone means America unavoidably takes long-term responsibility for Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the aftermath of war, about occupation, and Iraq is something like a 51st state. Our guest tonight is James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. And he's written a piece coming out in the November issue of The Atlantic, which is truly an important piece, looking at what the aftermath, the occupation, the cost and duration of that occupation, American occupation of Iraq, might be, would be. Is there any way America can just get in and get out of Iraq? Is this an opportunity for democracy and oil security, or is this an occupation quagmire? And does preemptive war mean different? Does it mean greater responsibilities for the United States? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Jim Fallows, I'm sorry to have interrupted you before the break, but you're making the case that if we do this primarily on America's hook, and George Bush has not been shy about saying we're fully prepared to do that, then the responsibility in the aftermath falls more squarely than we are accustomed to, certainly in the last decade and more, on American shoulders.
Yes, I think it's worth emphasizing sort of the 1-2 punch of what makes this war unusual. One is that it would be preemptive. You know, the administration is arguing that it's necessary before there is harm rather than because we've been attacked. And second, it would be either unilateral or pretty much on our own unless, you know, we can convince the administration, convince the United Nations or some Arabs to go along. And that combination, I think, makes the U.S. exposed in a way it has not been in any of its previous adventures for the inescapable carnage that will be done there in the process of getting rid of Saddam Hussein.
You have talked to a lot of people who have experience in nation building, nation rebuilding, occupation experience even as far back as post-World War II in Japan and Germany, and you've laid out what you call a triage list for American occupiers, which is what American forces will become, assuming Saddam Hussein is overthrown and the U.S. takes over Iraq. I hope you'll just walk us through this, starting with the first day. You're looking at it through a number of lenses, the first day, the first week, the first month, and on. The first day, what's going to confront Americans after victory?
Well, there was an American who lived in Saudi Arabia for 18 years who was pointing out to me what a number of military people did too, which is the first day depends on what happened on the last couple of days in the war. And the particular scenario that's most concern to people is what exactly Saddam Hussein will have done with his chemical and biological weapons. It's taken for granted that he will use them on the battlefield against U.S. troops. That's one reason why people think that a cool weather attack would be more likely because of these heavy suits the U.S. troops would have to wear. Question is what he will have done to Israel and what in particular Ariel Sharon's government will have done back. If there is, I think the nightmare scenario here, not the probability, but the worst fear is there will be a Scud attack on Israel, and Israel will then attack somebody else, Saudi Arabia, some other Arab country, and you'll have the sort of Armageddon-like religious war in the Middle East that some of the fundamentalists...
Why Saudi Arabia? Why not just a kick straight back at Iraq itself if that's where the missile comes from?
Well, if you're going... From the cleanest logic, the Sharon government will do what happened with the Shamir government during the Gulf War of obeying American requests, please, please, please to leave the retaliation to the Americans. And if that happened, that would be the cleanest thing to do. It seems less likely that Ariel Sharon would agree to that than Shamir. And so if he retaliated only against Iraq, that would be at least a contained effort. But there is, I mention it only to say that a planner's concern is some escalation of the war to include other Arab targets.
So in that sense, the first day of what would have been peace could be also the first day of a regional war.
Yes, and to be clear, this, unlike the other things I'm talking about, is their nightmare fear as opposed to their expectation.
So here's in a conditional category. Let's assume that doesn't happen, that the U.S. military is effective, it's successful, it's, you know, as I hate to use the word, but clean as it can be in making regime change come about. What does it face?
Well, then you have the sort of necessities of the triage list of the first week. The first of them, obviously, is going to be you will have killed a lot of people and blown up a lot of things in the process of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. There is a retired General William Nash, who was a lead combat leader during the Gulf War and then in charge of various efforts in Bosnia and Kosovo, and he was pointing out that one way or another, a lot of Iraq is going to be damaged. Either we're going to blow up, the U.S. forces are going to blow up roads, bridges, airfields, et cetera, on the way in, or the Iraqis will do it to keep the U.S. forces from coming in. there'll be electrical systems destroyed. There'll be shortages of water. There'll be shortages of food. Another relief officer was saying there's always an immediate problem of currency, how people get money to buy anything. And so there'll be this kind of immediate refugee crisis. Bodies will need to be buried. Hospitals will need to be set up. And so there have to be plans for some tens of thousands of people, mainly Iraqis, who will need to be taken care of.
And so this is the first week we're talking, really. And after the dancing and throwing of flowers, if that's what we find, you've got people who need food and water and shelter and won't necessarily have them. You write that because the United States started the war, the United States will have accepted a moral responsibility for these people. You may well have totally obliterated the social and political structure that had been providing these services. Boom, there's a responsibility.
Yes, and significantly, that was a retired two-star general who was actually saying that I quoted. This is not some pinko me saying it. It's the general who was in the Gulf War. That this is the kind of thing the Army is keeping track of. The next first week contingency that many people in the military are concerned about is, where is Saddam Hussein? You know, it is certainly militarily feasible and reasonable to imagine the U.S. taking over and crushing the army of Iraq. Actually, knowing what has happened to Saddam Hussein is a less sure bet, as Osama bin Laden illustrates. Another retired general, the former chief of staff of the Air Force, Merrill McPeak, was saying that his nightmare scenario is going in, taking Baghdad, and then you just don't know where the guy is. You don't know if he's dead, he's on the road, and then you have yet another mythic figure for the Arab world whom we can't catch.
So another challenge. Could be caught, but he's a wily guy, could get away in the fog of war.
Yes, and so that's the kind of those two things: dealing with the refugees, finding food and especially water for people in the first week, and figuring out where Saddam Hussein actually is. That's kind of the first week.
And there's the humanitarian challenge plus Saddam. On the humanitarian challenge, do we have the forces, the resources, the food, shelter, water in the region to keep the country from starving and you know, frying under the sun immediately upon American troops' arrival?
And, of course, you know, the U.S. is the world's great supplier of food, of hospital tents, and things like that. But this is a big effort and a big expenditure, and there have been various estimates placed on this. Another former military officer, Scott Files, estimating would be, you know, somewhere in the $1 billion per month range, but no one really knows. The point is, it's a serious undertaking that's part of the war planning, what you do once you win.
And $1 billion a month that the United States is likely to be paying, not Japan, not Saudi Arabia, not others.
Yes, because during the first Gulf War, there's argument about whether the U.S. actually made a profit or came close to making a profit in the sense of having contributions from its allies that more than covered our outlays. One way or another, we got a lot of money from a lot of other countries, and it's much less likely for that to happen this time.
Let's turn to the first month. What issues come up on the screen as we expand? Now we're through the first week. People are being fed one way or another. What challenges come up for an occupying American force in Iraq, a victorious force?
The next challenge in that first month is essentially controlling the place and setting up police forces. And let's assume that in the first couple of days, the people in Iraq are all just jubilant to be rid of Saddam Hussein. And as we saw in Afghanistan in the first few days, they are strewing, you know, they are celebrating the arrival of U.S. troops, et cetera. That doesn't last forever. And you need to start installing, you know, police forces and one of the things which almost all the people I spoke with said would happen is sort of self-help retribution. Again, this General Nash I mentioned said you try to control the retribution, but you just find the bodies each morning. There's nothing to do about that.
The people who've been oppressed by Saddam's regime are likely to strike back at their oppressors.
Yes, and they'll be trying to figure out who was a quisling, who they have built up resentment with, who killed their cousin 8 years ago. And so
there could be a bloodletting, whatever the Americans might like. This is a large country, population of 22 million, who organizes a police force that's more effective than what we've seen in Afghanistan, where there really hasn't been one organized.
Well, again, and the burden, if this is a mainly unilateral war, is on the U.S. with its non-Arab-speaking army. A rule of thumb here is it's supposed to take about one occupying policeman for each 500 people in the population, a certain number of supervisors. And so the rule of thumb is it would take somewhere between 50,000 and 75,000 long-term police slash, you know, military patrol people just to keep order. That's, you know, the U.S. Army no longer has, U.S. military no longer has a huge surplus of people to throw around. Before September 11th of last year, the Reserve and National Guard had about 5,000 people mobilized. Now they have about 80,000 people on permanent mobilization around the world. And there could be troops redeployed from Germany and Japan and Korea, where there are a lot of them. But coming up with the soldiers is not seen as a trivial matter by the military because it's a long-term thing.
It's an enormous manpower requirement. Next up, forming a government. Saddam Hussein has been the be-all and end-all, and he's presumably one way or another gone.
And if we think it's difficult in Afghanistan, where at least Mr. Karzai was on hand, it's all the harder for Iraq, where there is one putative leader, this Mr. Chalabi, who's head of the exile community, but the local support for him seems to be thin, precisely because Saddam Hussein has been so effective as a tyrant. There are not a lot of on-scene alternatives to him. And so the sort of grim prediction by most people I spoke with was, as one British intelligence officer said, that you need a man with a black mustache. You need some other guy, some other strong man. Eventually, such a person will emerge, but it's not going to be a quick process or necessarily a nice one. And so there'll be a need for something that the U.S. military of the moment is not that comfortable doing, which is a sort of Douglas MacArthur type figure. Until we can find some Iraqi to run the government, it'll be some American soldier, presumably, or some American of some sort. And the military shies from that, the military of the post-Vietnam era.
If they shy from it, will someone do it? Will there be an American general sitting in one of Saddam's former palaces, as MacArthur did in Japan, practically ruling Iraq?
Well, nature abhors a vacuum, and so somebody will exert power in Iraq, but all there's kind of no obvious candidate for the role. No Karzai, no MacArthur, nobody, Mrs. Aquino from the Philippines to step right in. So somebody will step in, but it's not obvious who that will be, and filling the vacuum again will be a U.S. responsibility.
Maybe an American consul almost at the beginning, and then perhaps a strong man. There are a lot of people who want to join this call. We've got more to go through, but let's invite them in. Chuck's calling from Sherburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hi. I was thinking, first of all, that beyond the humanitarian concerns of the mess afterwards is the political concerns, because Turkey and others have to be reassured that there's stability in the region. And Turkey is constantly worried about the Kurds. But beyond that, I'm just wondering, what kind of a skill set do you need? I'm looking at Afghanistan, to occupy. I'm looking at Afghanistan, and we show absolutely no ability, as far as I can tell, to deal with the political side of events. We're still out there hunting bin Laden. We supply a police force to protect Karzai, who is, we picked a minority from somebody from a minority. It just seems.
And Afghanistan's peanuts compared to Iraq.
Yes, exactly. I mean, how in the world does anybody know what kind of a skill sets we're going to need? These are new skill sets.
Chuck, you raised two big issues, actually. And if we could, James Fallows, let's look at the first one first. And that is, does this country hold together? The United States takes over Iraq. Does it risk crumbling in our hands, falling to pieces in our hands?
Well, this was actually going to be the next item on the triage list. As we've all come to hear in the last month or two, Iraq has sort of a natural tripartite division. There are the Kurd regions in the north. There are the Shiite regions in the south near Iran. And there's the Sunni Ottoman center near Baghdad. Most people think that after Saddam Hussein, Iraq would not be like Yugoslavia, that is flying apart into actual shards, but more like Indonesia, where there are real obvious tensions, but a sort of a government that is constantly streaming against them from the center.
But always a separatist dynamic as well.
Exactly. So you have, it wouldn't be, shattered, but the strain of holding it together would be the central political issue, partly for the reason that Chuck mentioned, because the Turks are so upset about the Kurds in the north. Partly because the U.S. would be upset about having some kind of alliance between the Shia regions and Iran, which is also a concern. So territorial integrity, here's the way this would become the real problem for the U.S. Suppose there were a Kurdish uprising in the north, which is always sort of rumored and has happened many times for the last century.
Certainly imaginable.
Somebody is going to put it down. Either it will be the Turks or it will be the U.S. occupying forces. Somebody is going to ensure the territorial integrity of Iraq, which is in the interest basically of all the countries of the region except the Kurds. And either the U.S. will let it happen by the Turks or we'll have to do it.
That sounds unimaginable, though, James Fallows. Can you imagine that we would take over Iraq and then turn around and become a kind of step into the shoes of the oppressor? I mean, Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds. Saddam Hussein went after the Shia.
Well, you know, let's play the imagination game. Put yourself in your old foreign correspondent role. Mm-hmm. You're out there in Baghdad. The Kurds, as it's very easy to imagine, are having their uprising, and the Turkish tanks are rolling. So what does the U.S. proconsul do? Do we go to the border and fight the Turks, our NATO ally? You know, it is any of the likely outcomes is difficult to imagine, but one of them is going to happen.
So the U.S. lays down the law and says, Kurds, Shiites, you will be part of this country whether you like it or not, and here's a U.S. soldier who's going to enforce that if you don't like it.
Yes, and as a bonus, as sort of the beauty part of this, is the U.S. soldiers would also be down there on the border with Iran, because that's the border which, you know, 500,000 men lost their lives in during the 1980s between Iran and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is the big power of that region, the one that's more feared by the Arab countries in the long run than Iraq, and so protecting that border, too, becomes our job.
Are you suggesting Iran might take advantage of this moment to actually make a move on Iraq or part of Iraq?
I think the idea would be in the mind of most countries in that region of instability would be, you know, if there had been a battle over that region for so many years at such cost, what would be in it for Iran to lose? But one way or another, to protect against Iraq's most exposed border, somebody would need to defend it. And again, the default candidate would be the U.S.
U.S. soldiers defending the borders of Iraq. What about the skill set question that Chuck raised? Do we have Americans who are prepared to do this kind of work, this nation building?
Indeed. And I met and talked with some of these sort of civil affairs specialists. And these people do exist. They're very colorful. I enjoyed talking to them. I described some of them in the piece. The main thing about them is there aren't that many of them. And so if the U.S. forces are stretched in general, particularly in the Guards and Reserves, which are where many of these civil affairs people are found, this is a very scarce resource at the moment. So we'd have to cobble up a lot of them in a hurry.
How many Arabic speakers do we have? I mean, can we even communicate with the Iraqis?
I think the safe answer is we don't have anywhere near enough. I mentioned one senior three-star general who's an Arabic speaker, and they are sort of sprinkled throughout the special forces, but everybody recognizes this as a huge case for having some kind of at least fig leaf of Arab alliance. So you have actual translators.
You write about, and I remember, situations in the Gulf War where Americans had populations of Iraqis that were under their guns, but they couldn't speak to them effectively, and things really spiraled out of hand.
You know, anybody who's been in this situation, as you and I both have, you know, in other parts of the world, where you are dependent on translators and interpreters to know what's going on with a large foreign population, it is not in the long run a desirable situation. In the occupations of both Germany and Japan, the U.S. had the advantage of some members of its own population who, you know, were native speakers of both German and Japanese. And Japanese Americans, even though they'd been interned, were an important part of the occupation force. There are fewer of those available people at the moment who speak Arabic.
James Fellows, you pull the curtains back as always for us, and it's quite a sight to see. We're talking tonight with James Fellows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, about the aftermath of war, about occupation and Iraq as something like a 51st American state. You can join the conversation. Does the full challenge of occupation change your mind about the wisdom of going into Iraq in the first place? Is this an opportunity for democracy and oil security? Or is this an occupation quagmire? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the aftermath of war, about occupation, and Iraq as something like, in the words of our guest tonight, James Fellows, a 51st state after and assuming a victorious campaign against Saddam Hussein. Our guest is James Fellows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. He has an important piece coming out in that magazine's November issue. I encourage you to pick it up and read it. It goes through step by step what will be required to hold the country together, to pull it up out of the devastation, that's what it is, of war, and looks toward the future of perhaps a very long-term occupation. Are you prepared to see American troops defending Iraq's border with Iran for years? Does preemptive war mean greater responsibilities? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Megan's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Megan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I'm wondering how well nation building would actually work in Iraq, because it all sounds very nice on paper, but a lot of those governments and a lot of those heads of state were put in place by the West, and a lot of those have fallen apart. And plus, their culture and their religion is so different, and a lot of the population feel very uncomfortable about Western things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if it would actually work. But if it, I mean, I hope it does, and I am committed to the Iraqi people if we would actually win this hypothetical war.
But will it work? And that is the question. Megan, thank you for your call. James Fallows, I mean, that asks for a kind of summary judgment here. But among all the people you talk to, what's the sentiment? Is this work? We haven't even finished the list of long-term obligations here, but is it doable?
Well, there's a division of opinion which I think runs along these lines. Most people with experience in the Arabic world are deeply skeptical of the idea that Iraq or its neighbors can be made into long-term democratic capitalist societies for reasons that Megan was mentioning and others we can all think of.
But as we talked about at the top of the hour, there is another view, a very positive view, almost a let's go, we can't get to it soon enough view, that this is exactly the way to begin a reshaping of the entire region.
Well, there's a view that I personally disagree with, but that I respect, and that I quote mainly from Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director, mm-hmm. one of the most visible pro-war spokesmen. And his view is that if Germany and Japan could be remade into very stable democracies after their militarist past, if the Soviet Empire can be transformed in the way that it has, then it is condescending and wrong to say that this can't happen in the Arabic world. On the basis of my relatively limited experience in that part of the world, I'm skeptical of it. The reason I respect it is that people making that argument at least are being serious about this being a long-term undertaking. And Woolsey, to his credit, says, you know, there's something that would be decades and decades, but he argues it would be worth it, the same kind of transformational opportunity as the German and Japanese experiences.
Take us through a couple more time frames while we've got you. First year, you write about the equivalent of denazification that will have to go on. Presumably that means pulling out the intolerable portions of Saddam Hussein's political mechanism.
Well, there's a fine line here between getting rid of the people who really need to be gotten rid of, the war criminals, the people whose continued presence would be seen as an affront to everything, and getting to some kind of Khmer Rouge-type situation where you're just purging anybody who had any sort of official connection. This, again, is why it would be useful to have some sort of Arabic connection, some way of knowing what was going on in the fabric of the society, not letting it resort to warlordism. There also is the process we're now seeing painfully going through in Afghanistan of trying to have some loya jirgaization, if you will, some kind of new constitutional assembly. You need both a person to run the government and some new basis for a government. And that, too, there's no sort of obvious domestic roots of that, and the U.S. would have to be sort of propping it up with as many allies as it could. As you know, Tom, in Japan, this was a very, very deep and painstaking process of going into the schools, of rewriting the Constitution, rewriting the labor law.
Really a culture remade, or at least the framework laid down for a remade culture.
Indeed. And again, John Dower of MIT was saying this was possible in Japan because of the unquestioned international support for the legitimacy of our doing it. And the Japanese understanding, too, they'd been just crushed by, you know, after their own aggression. A similar effort in Iraq, I think, would be a challenge.
One more call. Victor is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Good evening. Well, thanks.
I believe that we do have a responsibility to be over there. You know, no one likes our troops to be there, but since we are, you know, we've been handed the plate of being global policemen, we have to take that responsibility. And plus, we have a responsibility for Iraq anyway, because during that war between Iran and Iraq in the 80s, we supported Saddam Hussein. So he is our responsibility, you know, believe it or not. Some people would be chagrined to hear that, but
But you see him as on our hook already, Victor, and this is a cup we can't turn away from. Victor, thank you for your call. James Fallows, what about it? There are clearly American footprints all over the region. It's described by the Bush administration as a situation that has become acute, that has become intolerable, that's become too dangerous. In spite of all of this, do we have to go and try?
Well, I think it depends on what the on something that almost none of us in the public now knows, which is the evidence of how imminent the threat is. And if I had sort of an action conclusion that I came to after after talking with the people I did, it actually changed my mind about the desirability of a war. I began this process thinking, yeah, you know, probably it's better to do whatever we have to do sooner rather than later against Iraq. I ended up thinking, because of this long train of consequences, that the threshold was higher, that if there's any way short of preemptive war to contain this threat, we should try those things first. If there's no alternative, then there's no alternative, but we should be aware of what a long obligation this is going to be.
Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday before the House Armed Services Committee that one thing that would be very different here than Afghanistan is oil, and oil money that could be used to rebuild this country. Talk just briefly about oil and money. Is there enough to make Iraq the garden country of the Middle East?
Certainly in the long run, Iraq is different. Iraq probably doesn't have the same reserves as Saudi Arabia, but it comes close and may have, you know, more unexplored reserves. So in the long run, this could be a source of wealth for Iraq. It also is a source of great cynicism in the Arab world about our motivations in going in there. And resuscitating the oil industry and economy in Iraq would be an important occupation obligation, too. I think we'd have to look as if we weren't just stealing the oil fields, though, as the goal of the war.
But is there really enough money there, considering all the debt Iraq has and considering all the years of economic setback? Even if the oil spigot's turned on, is it enough to make Iraq bloom?
Well, I think that you very properly raise there's a short-term and a medium-term problem. The short-term problem is in the first year or so, the wealth in Iraq will not take care of the immediate sort of relief needs. There's a medium-term problem, too, which is after the Gulf War, Iraq was saddled with these gigantic reparations, hundreds of billions of dollars by the United Nations, which it can't possibly repay. It's a sort of a post-World War I Versailles-type thing, the kind of thing that Germany faced. So some sort of negotiated end to this unrealistic reparations burden would also be part of it. In the long run, certainly Iraq has oil wealth, but we've seen in other parts of the Middle East that hasn't necessarily translated into real and durable wealth.
We've just got a few seconds left, but how much difference does it make if the UN should come fully on board and this becomes truly a kind of a coalition effort?
I think it makes a big difference in the legitimacy of the undertaking and in practical things like having Arabic speakers along with you on the invasion force.
James Fallows, it's a terrific and eye-opening piece, and we thank you for all the work that you put into it, and thank you for being with us tonight. I encourage everybody to take a look at it. Jim, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly magazine. His article entitled "The 51st State" takes a hard look at America's long-term responsibilities in Iraq after victory. It will be published in the November issue of the Atlantic Monthly. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, On Point's Sarah Chase sees roadblocks in the reconstruction of Afghanistan. This is On Point. On Point's Eyes and Ears in Afghanistan, Sarah Chase brings us the voices, sounds, and stories of the people of Afghanistan. A former NPR reporter, Sarah is now based in Kandahar and works for the NGO Afghans for Civil Society. In this radio diary, Sarah Chase takes us to Akhalacha, a small Afghan village south of Kandahar. The people of Akhalacha are struggling to rebuild their homes, which were destroyed in the U.S.-led airstrikes last fall.
The other day, our engineer, Abdullah, came to me and said, there's a problem with the stone for Akhalacha. Akhalacha is a village south of Kandahar, the former Taliban stronghold in Afghanistan. It was half destroyed during an 11th-hour barrage of bombing just before the final victory over Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces. Citizens of the town of Concord, Massachusetts, and others have donated more than $18,000 to rebuild the 13 destroyed homes and the mosque, a way of showing, in deeds, not words, that last year's war really wasn't against the Afghan people. It's a tiny project in the vast sea of unaddressed needs here. But it's the only project I know of that aims to restore some of the private property, in this case, all these villagers own, that was inadvertently destroyed. Now, the problem engineer Abdullah was telling me about was that men with guns, the governor's men, were not allowing our tractor to load stone at the quarry. Zoo, I said. let's go see what's going on. The stone quarry is out one of the few paved roads here. It slices through the baked clay of the desert, past flocks of camels and the patchwork tents of impoverished nomads. The quarry owner was distraught. A bad man, he explained, had come with a Kalashnikov toting tough at his side and twisted a handful of the quarry owner's shirt collar in his fist. From now on, the man had told the quarry owner, no one can take stone from here unless he has a written order from Gulaha. Gulaha is the governor of Kandahar province. He was governor of Kandahar province in the early 1990s when the Taliban were on the rise. So much mayhem flourished on his watch then. Wanton murder, highway robbery, corruption, extortion, shakedowns. That much of the population welcomed the draconian rule of the Taliban as a respite. Now, thanks largely to U.S. backing, Gulaha is once again governor. The bad man who intimidated the quarry owner was Gulaha's brother-in-law. It turns out that the governor's brother and brother-in-law have gained an exclusive concession for all the stone in all the mountains on the south side of Kandahar. They plan to use it in a stone crusher to make gravel, which they're building in the old quarry using Pakistani labor. As for the quarry owner, who's been providing stone and gravel here for years, and whose machinery was also bombed and repaired, he's just out of luck. So is anyone south of the city who wants stone foundations for their mud brick houses. Zoo, I said, let's go see the governor. We went just before lunchtime. The gates to his compound are flanked by soldiers who roughly shove back the knot of petitioners at the gate. Open-back pickups with bunches of rocket launchers strapped to the struts like steel bananas are parked in a jumble. We're allowed through to the secretary. An old man with a white beard is pleading with the official, kissing his own fingertips and touching them to his eyes. Please give me my opium back, he says. The official tells him opium growing is illegal. Why is it illegal for me and not for Haji Abdullah, the old man asks. Haji Abdullah is the biggest opium dealer in Kandahar. He also owns a money-changing cash transfer business. He's stocky, has a white beard, and is lunching right now with the governor. We pass him on our way into the private quarters. We explain to Gulaha that we're rebuilding a village destroyed during the American bombing, one of the highest priorities in the province, and we need stone. The governor counters that he's making a cement factory, and all the stone in the southern hills must be saved for that cement factory. And stone blasting to the north of town must be stopped because it may damage historical monuments. Let me give you some advice, he says. Build brick foundations joined with cement. This is warlord government. It's not merely unjust and corrupt, harnessing the power of office for the personal gain of the office holder. It's also standing in the way of the reconstruction process, which is Afghanistan's only hope for a stable future. And Gulaha's soldiers, who sit at the gate and belittle petitioners, are wearing U.S. Army fatigues. In the eyes of Kandahar, what Gulaha does, he does with American blessing. At length, and with some subterfuge, and by taking the provincial minister of mines and industry all the way out to the quarry with us, we did obtain a special dispensation. 5 truckloads of stone have made their way to Akokalacha. Drywall foundations are going up. Our problem is solved, but not that of the quarry owner. What's he supposed to do? I asked the Minister of Mines and Industry. Go somewhere else, the minister answered with a shrug of his shoulders. And what about anyone else in Kandahar who might have new foundations to build?
Sarah Chase reports for On Point from Afghanistan. Her diaries appear on the program every few weeks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.